Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and wouldn't you know it, once again, it is time for one of what I believe to be your favorite segments among the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, which is our weekly Q&A with Layla. Judging from audience reaction and comments, it's a very popular segment. So with me today is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. Layla is, for those of you new to the podcast, is a registered dietitian. She has also earned a master's degree, and she has a CCN certification in nutrition. How are you doing, Layla?
I'm okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. And I might add that Layla is in her own right a broadcaster because recently, congratulations, we debuted a new Intelligent Medicine podcast, which is Layla's own podcast. Tell us a little bit about that podcast.
It was my inaugural podcast. It was on the 11th, and I talked briefly about a few topics, and I hope people will enjoy it. I will be weighing in with my perspective, any news or anything near and dear to me, or to the audience as well. So if they have a topic or a question, I welcome any and all questions or topics. You can email it to the radio program at AOL.com. Great. And I look forward to speaking to all of you.
Excellent. And appropriately enough, it is entitled Layla Weighs In. So we welcome that new podcast to our family of podcasts here at drhoffman.com. Check it out.
And I'll be weighing in weekly, so
indeed. Weigh in. Okay. So this week, I just want to give mention before we take questions. Usually we answer as many questions as we can during this segment.
Yeah.
And the way to get questions to us is via radio program at AOL.com, and the questions have been pouring in. We'll answer as many of them as we can in just a moment, but I just want to comment on a couple of stories that came out yesterday and today. Yesterday, the New York Times ran a fascinating article. Actually, it's a blog. It's entitled, A Decline in the Nutritional Value of Crops. And this is something that we've been saying for a while, is that modern crops, they just aren't what they used to be in terms of the nutritional value that they deliver. So, actually this sort of addresses the question many people ask, why should I bother to take vitamins and minerals if I just follow a healthy diet, eat plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables and a balanced diet? Mm-hmm. I'm going to get all the nutrients I need. Well, our ancestral diets were richer in nutrients. And because we hybridized a lot of food and because we don't fertilize the soil as we used to, we fertilize the soil for maximum growth. A lot of fruits and vegetables are just plumped up. They're sort of on steroids and, sort of like it's not
and
the
lacking
real deal.
Flavor as a result, but also nutrient content, apparently. So this is interesting, but it's true. To all the naysayers of supplements, here's the answer. We don't have enough minerals in our soil to support the nutrient content of our crops. Therefore, it's almost an insurance policy, at the very least, to take a multivitamin and mineral supplement.
And the other corollary, of course, is where possible, go organic, because actually studies have compared organic to conventional produce, showing that organic produce, sometimes it looks a little nubbier, sometimes the flavor is a little stronger. People aren't used to other than bland flavors. Organic produce actually packs more nutritional bang for your buck.
And don't be put off by that worm in your apple.
Right. It means that it's suitable for a living organism to consume. It's a good sign. Okay, so, if there's no worms on your apple, and that may mean that even a worm is smart enough to avoid the apple. You may not be, but the worm in its innate wisdom knows to avoid the apple. And here's another one. This one is a very interesting story that states – that an analysis of 21 studies, this is what's called a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis, meaning they weigh the value of all the studies relevant to a certain subject. An analysis of 21 studies shows exposure to pesticides is associated with an increased risk of, well, you might say, cancer. Okay, we know that these things mm-hmm. are, you know, dangerous. You might say Parkinson's disease. We already know that pesticides cause Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
This one says that they're associated with increased risk of developing diabetes. Now, check this out. Exposure to pesticides is associated with increased risk of developing diabetes by 61%. Okay.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And the ones that were most of concern are chlordane, oxychlordane, trans-nonachlor, DDT, DDE, dieldrin, heptachlorin, HCB. Well, actually, they're bringing back some of these pesticides that have previously been identified as dangerous, and partly because of GMO crops. GMO crops enable, well, this is an apples and oranges argument, because we're talking about herbicides when we talk about GMO crops. GMO crops are resistant. They're resistant to herbicides, you know, just like Roundup Ready
like
crops.
Like glyphosate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, glyphosate. Glyphosate, not a pesticide, it's an herbicide. But we can't have the supposition that the effects will be the same, but, you know, clearly these are...
Well, you know, farmers are now able to use 200 to 250% more Roundup because the GMO crops are so resistant.
Indeed.
And it's terrible. We're ingesting all of this.
Yep.
So even with the pesticides, anything that's going to, you know, kill off something like that, it can't be good for our systems.
Well, I suspect, you know, and this may be borne out by future research, is that in order to kill bugs, you do something to interfere with their metabolism and they die. Maybe these pesticides don't kill people, but what they do is they damage the mitochondria. And we know that diabetes is mm-hmm. a disease of inefficient mitochondrial energy production. And I suspect that what might be going on when we're exposed to multiple chemicals. And that may be why people feel lethargic. They have chronic fatigue syndrome. They have Parkinson's disease. And they sometimes have difficulty losing weight and they develop diabetes.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is really something, especially with so much of the population being either pre-diabetic, diabetic, or undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. Diabetes.
So we got to detox. We have to detox our diets.
We got to detox
and avoid chemicalized junk, pesticides, additives,
and be go organic.
Right.
Yeah.
And be discerning consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's launch into our question portion of our.
Well, Dr. Hoffman, actually, I do have to say something.
Okay.
On the previous newsletter, I really, really have to commend you on your latest article. That's titled, "You've Just Been Diagnosed with Breast Cancer, Don't Just Stand There, Do Nothing," part one. Because how you talk about and describe DCIS as a precancer, you know, those women who have been subjected to surgery, bilateral mastectomy, or anything like that, it's analogous to a pap smear that's come back abnormal.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Should those women have their uteruses yanked out as a result? I mean, aren't we kind of talking about the same thing here as a precancer?
Exactly.
It's not a cancer.
And, you know, I didn't include this in the article. By the way, that's the first of a three-part article. So in part one, you know, we kind of lay out the case for what we term active holistic surveillance. That's at drhoffman.com. And next week in the newsletter, we'll be talking about, and some of you may have already seen that newsletter by the time you hear this podcast, we'll be talking about specific suggestions for diet. And I really go into detail about some of the theories about the diet relationship to breast cancer. And then we talk also about other lifestyle elements like exercise and stress that are important. Sleep, too, may play a role and so on. And then in part three, we name 18 supplements. Specific supplements that have been documented, not just to prevent breast cancer, because here we're talking about women who have already been diagnosed with DCIS, but have been shown to slow the progression or prevent recurrence after a diagnosis of breast cancer. So, you know, we want to use scientifically documented nutraceuticals in an effort to help women who are, you know, it's not just about doing nothing. I mean, that's sort of like clickbait when I write, don't just stand there, do nothing.
Right.
What I mean to say is it's very much an active process. It's not a do nothing thing, but it's active on the lifestyle front, not so much on the surgical, chemo, hormonal blockade front. Because look, I'm all for aggressive treatment of breast cancer in cases where it makes a difference. But when the science tells us that it doesn't make a difference for this early type of breast cancer, we've got to pay heed to it. And we've got to get women to act as if they are similar to the men with early prostate cancer who seem to be doing well with that.
Excellent, excellent article. For those of you who don't subscribe to the newsletter, go to drhoffman.com and sign up. Wonderful, wonderful article. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, Lila, and I'm glad this article resonated for you as a woman. Good. All right, so let's get to some questions.
We've got a question here from Mark. Let's see here. Mark's father is an 83-year-old, and he has severe aortic stenosis. Mark's question is it possible to, is there anything on the natural end of the spectrum for him to deal with aortic stenosis?
Okay, well, let's explain what aortic stenosis is. It's actually a fairly common condition in older individuals in their 80s and 90s. And what happens is the aorta, which actually is the outflow tract of the heart, it pumps blood upwards towards the brain, but also downwards via the abdominal aorta and via the femoral arteries to your viscera, your intestines, your guts, and also your legs. So this is a big pipe, and after years and years and years of Western diet and being exposed to the pressure of the pumping action, the aorta sometimes fills up with calcium and becomes stenosed, which means narrowed. And as a result, the heart has to work overtime, and then the heart can enlarge, and you can develop flabby heart muscle and heart failure. You can often develop atrial fibrillation as a result of this. And it's actually something where blood pressure medication doesn't work anymore because you actually have it's kind of a narrowing of the outflow pipe. It's sort of like, you know, when you adjust your garden hose and to a fine spray, and finally you get to a certain point after twisting the nozzle that the flow stops. It goes to a dribble, so you're not getting enough blood flow. It could be very dangerous. So this actually is mostly dealt with surgery. Nowadays they're actually introducing some ways to do the surgery, I think, percutaneously, without cracking open the chest, with running a catheter up through the chambers of the heart. It's introduced via the femoral blood vessel, sometimes through the arm. And so these older, sometimes delicate patients don't have to undergo open heart surgery, which is potentially dangerous. Surgery is the answer. At some point, you really need to have surgery. And it's amazing that some of these oldsters, like well into their 80s and 90s, they get the surgery and they get a new lease on life. They're less short of breath, you know, they have better circulation, and so on. But in terms of, like, staving off the inevitability of that, I might suggest coenzyme Q10, because coenzyme Q10 helps the pumping action of the heart. And I'll tell you just a little anecdote is that I have a – you know, I might have told the story already, but, you know, I'll bore you with the story again. Is I have a friend who had a couple of little dogs, King Charles Spaniels, and those dogs are prone to valvular disorders. You know, when they very carefully breed these dogs, you know, for one characteristic or another, sometimes they inbreed certain adverse characteristics. Dog owners understand this. They understand that, like, German Shepherds have bad hips, certain dogs have certain bad traits, you know, like those bulldogs have a lot of respiratory problems because they have a funny nose, whatever. So one trait that King Charles Spaniels have is they have valvular disease. And so, you know, usually every time I would knock on the door, I'd hear yap, 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 and the dogs come scurrying up to the door and greet me, you know, jump on my feet. And so this time I, you know, came to the door, and one dog came, and the other dog just kind of sat there panting. And I said, oh, you know, what's wrong with the dog? And he says, oh, that dog has valvular disease. He's going to die. Or she's going to die. And so, okay, well, you know, how long does the dog have like that? The vet says probably like next 3 months, you know, we might have to put him down. So I said, okay, well, look, this works in my human patients. Why don't you try this? This is a small dog, so try 50 milligrams of CoQ10. You know, maybe in a human, you might need 200 or 400 milligrams of CoQ10, or you might need, 100 milligrams of ubiquinol twice daily, something like that. And I said, fine, I don't visit this person very often. So I came back, you know, maybe 6 months, 8 months later, and knock on the door, dogs bark, two dogs rush up to me, and I said, wow, you know, you got another dog. He said, no. He said, that's the same dog. I said, what do you mean? Oh. He says, well, ever since I gave the dog CoQ10, the dog has rallied, seems to be doing better, and, you know, that's and there's no placebo effect with the dog, right? You know, I didn't tell the dog that the dog was going to feel better.
Exactly. So really, hey, dog, you're taking CoQ10, so you can expect to feel better.
Right. So there you have it.
Oh, wow.
That's called an N-of-1 animal experiment. But I think
it's also
it
called you moonlighting as a veterinarian.
Right. Hey, please do not send a torrent of veterinary questions to me, because I'm not qualified to answer them. But, you know, any vets out there, I'm sure vets are great, because they really are very innovative, and they will try stuff that a lot of conventional regular medical doctors won't try, you know, in an effort to save animals. So, and as long as it's not dangerous and harmless, it's worth a try.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Mark, thank you for your question, and good luck with your father.
Indeed.
All right. We have another question from Evelyn. I was wondering if you can shed some light on geographic tongue. I recently had this burning sensation and redness on my tongue. I've been to a dentist, an oral surgeon, an internist. They said it was geographic tongue, and it's not serious. But I'm still concerned about how to treat it or get rid of it. I've rinsed with baking soda. It comes and it goes. I'm 63. I eat well. I take vitamins, probiotics. I'm a long-time listener to your podcast. I was hoping you can help me. Can you recommend any treatments?
Yeah, geographic tongue is kind of a controversial thing, because
does it have to do with food allergy?
I believe it does, but if you look at conventional medical sites, like right now I'm looking this up on the Mayo Clinic site, it says geographic tongue is a harmless condition affecting the surface of your tongue. Although geographic tongue may look alarming, it doesn't cause health problems. It isn't associated with infection or cancer, blah, 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 blah. So they're basically reassuring patients that, yeah, your tongue looks really lousy, and it looks like, you know, the continents of the world on a world map, but it means nothing. I actually do think that there is a relationship between the appearance of your tongue and what's going on internally. In fact, that's there's a whole science of that within traditional Chinese medicine. Is they look at your tongue and they come up with all kinds of conclusions about your internal state. And they use tongue diagnosis, pulse diagnosis, facial diagnosis as a means of ascertaining, you know, what to do with you. So, I think that it's very likely that someone who has geographic tongue, there may be an underlying cause. Since the tongue is sort of the external presentation of the digestive tract, it's the beginning of your digestive tract, it suggests that there may be some trouble downstream. There may be leaky gut syndrome. There may be some inflammation downstream. There may be biofilms of, you know, harmful bacteria or some dysbiosis internally that's causing that. And so, you know, I don't think it's a matter of using a tongue scraper or, you know, just using some baking soda or some kind of antiseptic mouthwash. I think it argues for a search for some sort of underlying imbalance.
Interesting.
Precisely what imbalance, I can't tell you. And it isn't always candida, but it can be associated with a yeast infection. But a geographic tongue is different. It's not necessarily a yeast infection.
Right, right. I know some of the other features of the tongue that I know of, besides a white coat for candida or maybe a yellow coat for maybe detoxification issues, unless you've just had coffee at Starbucks or something like that. Sometimes that'll cause a little bit of a yellow tongue just from the coffee. Or scalloped edges around the tongue are indicative of allergy because the tongue may be inflamed. But I've heard of geographic tongue.
A very red tongue may be a sign of riboflavin deficiency.
Yeah.
Vitamin
B2. Mm-hmm.
Right. But I have to say, though, that I don't think it's that. Sometimes I see these guides, you know, which say, well, your tongue looks like this, you need this vitamin. It's not that simple, you know, as like a one-to-one kind of thing.
Right, right. All right. Well, Evelyn, Thank you for your question. I don't know how often people should rinse with baking soda. Doesn't that harm the enamel or something? Or even using an antiseptic mouthwash.
Oh, I hate
those,
yeah. Because
that could also kill beneficial bacteria in
absolutely,
the mouth.
Absolutely. So, you know, baking soda is probably innocuous. I mean, it's not acidic. An acidic thing can actually harm the enamel. Even people who chew vitamin C capsules or do chewable vitamins, they can actually strip the enamel from their teeth. But I think baking soda is pretty innocuous, probably.
Okay. Evelyn, thank you for your question. Hopefully you'll find the answer. We have actually a similar question from Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hoffman, I've been diagnosed with burning mouth syndrome. The root cause can't be confirmed, but I feel it evolved because of some dental work which caused me to self-soothe one side of my mouth by rubbing it with my tongue. The dental issue's never been resolved even after 5 years. And I had multiple injections of Novocaine, and maybe that caused some kind of nerve damage.
It absolutely. You know, there's a really interesting article. I mean, look, I'm not a dentist, and this might be a case for a holistic dentist. Some really interesting research came out recently about the effect of lots of Novocaine in kids on their development of their teeth. And apparently, you know, a lot of kids have problems with their so-called baby teeth, and they get Novocaine for working on their baby teeth. But underneath the baby teeth, of course, are growing the normal adult teeth. Well, it turns out that the use of Novocaine or these local anesthetics affects the development of the underlying teeth. So there can be some ramification. I mean, we think of it as just a temporary thing. It, you know, everybody knows you go to the dentist, and then they tell you not to eat anything for a couple hours so you don't bite your tongue. And then, you know, you start feeling the sensation return. You start feeling a little tingling at first, and then finally the sensation returns. It takes, 2 hours. But actually, there may be some, because you block the nerves, there may be some subtle effects on the teeth that are developing and that may require nerve stimulation or blood circulation. We don't precisely know why that happens. But, you know, I'm not sure that I can answer this question adequately or if there is a quick and easy answer.
Yeah. This does sound dental about Kathy. I know some causes of burning mouth may be a deficiency of maybe possibly one of the B vitamins like B6.
Absolutely. Well, we also know that alpha-lipoic acid helps burning mouth. Sometimes the problem, sometimes you even require, medication that's good for nerve pain, like Lyrica, Neurontin. Sometimes it's a candida infection or yeast infection. Sometimes we soothe the mouth with licorice extract, which is helpful for ulcers. It's also helpful for soothing the mouth. Potent extract of licorice called DGL is often helpful for burning mouth syndrome. So
maybe a glutamine swish and swallow something.
But alpha-lipoic acid is helpful for the nerves, and we know that in diabetic neuropathy it's helpful. But in this, we actually have some studies out of Germany that suggest that high-dose alpha-lipoic acid helps burning mouth syndrome because it's a nerve disorder rather than an inflammation of the gums or the tongue.
Wow.
So
some alpha-lipoic.
It's complicated.
Acid.
There's no... in treating burning mouth syndrome, I found that a variety of approaches, an allergy elimination diet, avoiding obvious things like mint gum, mouthwashes, irritating substances, getting rid of yeast, sometimes a trial of antifungal medication, alpha-lipoic acid, or sometimes even an antidepressant medication at a low dose, or Neurontin, Lyrica. These are medications that have side effects, of course, but they can reduce the terrible discomfort that's associated with this condition. It can be debilitating.
Wow. Best of luck to Kathy.
Yep.
Okay. We hope you get some relief soon.
Indeed. So this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, as those knowledgeable with this series know. And when we return, give us a preview of what we're going to have in part two.
Are there any supplements for mitigating middle schmerz?
All right. Coming up in part two. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.